Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, New York Times Radio, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Among the takeaway topics we're following this morning, of course, the situation in Myanmar, the fact that it's primary day in North Carolina and Indiana, and I love that fact we reported earlier today. If you bought a house in 2006, there's more than a 50-50 chance you owe more on your mortgage than your home is worth.
That's devastating news for those folks who bought those homes. And it's an enormous number. It's quite shocking.
Yes, and it's rising.
And not to mention, so is oil prices.
That's right. Well, and speaking of oil prices, at the risk of angering some climatologists, let me remind you all of something, including you, Adora. The Earth is actually not running out of oil. There is plenty of fossil fuel to last for centuries and centuries and centuries. What we are running out of is oil that is easy to get out of the ground, the liquid, easy to pump stuff. But what about energy in hard-to-obtain tar fields and other deposits of oily goo? With the right scientific coaxing, it turns out Canada and Venezuela could be the next Saudi Arabia. Professor Steve Larder of Newcastle University and the University of Calgary says energy-starved humanity has an ally in a very unusual microbe. Professor Larder, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Explain how this microbe is an ally of energy-starved humanity.
Well, what we've been researching for many, many years is the origin of what so-called heavy oil. So the kind of oil you've been talking about is what most listeners would be familiar with as a sort of a brown, easily runny liquid, about the same viscosity or runniness as, say, hot tea. What we've been looking at is most of the world's oil, which is a kind of thick, sort of viscous, goopy material that's very hard to recover because it flows very, very slowly. And what we've discovered is that this material is produced in subsurface oil reservoirs by microorganisms actually eating the regular kind of runny type of oil and leaving this residue of horrible, gunky, viscous, heavy oil. And what these organisms do is they actually eat the regular oil by reacting it with water, common old garden water, and in the process they produce methane, natural gas, some carbon dioxide, and the residue they leave is the heavy oil. So
now, is it possible that this microbe could actually produce a useful energy source by turning these tar sands and oily goo into enough natural gas to actually be of use?
Well, that's what we're looking at, and it's not a microbe. It's a whole group of microorganisms all working together.
How have you speeded up the process?
Well, what we're trying to do, and we haven't done it yet, but what we're trying to do is actually essentially do what farmers do, and that's actually fertilize the organisms. So they are running very, very slowly in the subsurface, eating crude oil, producing natural gas, but they're doing it far too slowly for that to be a commercially viable way of recovering natural gas. So one of the things we do is essentially just feed them nutrients, fertilize them with sort of basically very similar materials that farmers would use to fertilize plants.
And what is the amount? Can you give us a sense of what we're talking about? When you say that there is this tar sand, this gooey residue left, how much of it is there out there, and how much would then these microbes be able to affect what's there?
Well, in terms of, you know, just the quantity of this heavy oil and oil sand bitumen, as we call the extremely viscous stuff, there's probably many trillions of barrels, so that's sort of 10 with a 12 exponent, and in Western Canada, for example, there's something like about 1.3 trillion barrels of oil sand bitumen, and you compare that with, say, the oil reserves of Saudi Arabia, which are around 700 billion barrels. So
about
twice as much material in Western Canada as there is in Saudi Arabia. Worldwide, there are several trillion barrels of this very viscous heavy oil, and currently the energy industry can recover typically less than about 15% of this material from a typical reservoir.
You know, it's interesting. You talk about the scale of this, but one of the interesting and convenient things about Saudi Arabia is that the oil's all nicely packed away in a little cave down under the ground. How would you actually get, if you were able to scale this process up and produce natural gas, how would you keep it from just sort of bubbling away and be kind of stinky and unharvestable?
Well, you've got to remember the oil is in the same kind of reservoir that naturally traps natural gas, too.
So you drill a hole, you pump in some microbes, and then you pump out the gas.
Well, no, even better than that. You've probably already drilled your hole because you've been recovering some oil. The microbes are already down there, so we don't have to get kind of worried about, three-headed monsters coming out of the earth or anything.
I do worry about them, so.
The microorganisms, they're already there. I think what a lot of people don't realize is something like 90% of all the microorganisms on planet Earth are actually in planet Earth. They're actually living in the subsurface at depths down to about 4,000 meters. So they're already there. They're doing their thing. What you would do is you would add some fertilizer, some nutrients, down probably already existing well bores. You'd let that soak for a while. You'd speed up that natural process, produce the natural gas, which won't bubble away. It will just partially dissolve in the water and the oil, partially accumulate in that reservoir because that's sealed off, and then later on you just produce it out of another production well.
Well, Professor Larder, that's quite a recipe for dealing with the energy crisis on planet Earth, if not the carbon climate global warming problem, but that's a story for another day. Professor Steve Larder of Newcastle University and the University of Calgary, thank you very much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Very interesting. And time for some more headlines. Femi?
Good morning. It is 28 minutes past the hour. Polls are open in a little over 30 minutes' time, and that's for the primaries in Indiana and North Carolina, where residents will go to the polling booths. Elsewhere around the world, a new Amnesty International report on Somalia says all parties concerned in the conflict have continued to carry out killings, torture, rape, beatings, arbitrary detention, and forced disappearances. Amnesty International says civilians trying to flee the violence are completely at the mercy of government troops with no safety for Somalis. China's President Hu Jintao has begun his five-day visit to Japan, making a warming in relations. Recently, China-Japan relations have been tense, says Tomohiko Taniguchi. He's the spokesman for Japan's foreign ministry.
At the end of the day, the two nations have got lots of problems, and the number of the problems will be on the rise, not on the decline, simply because the flows of people, goods, knowledge and information are intense.
This is President Hu Jintao's first trip outside of China since protests erupted across Tibet. And finally, small steps have been made between Chinese officials and representatives from the Dalai Lama. A recent meeting to address recent protests was met with optimism. Both sides have agreed to a second talk in the near future.
That's interesting. It sounds optimistic between China and Tibet.
Well, it's a start, and like so many talks that are happening in international conflicts, we will continue to follow them.
Yes, between now and the Olympics, much more to come. Thank you, Femi Okeh.
Hey, you're very welcome.